Did you know that as more people listen to WNYC on the internet, our bandwidth expenses go up? Please do your part to support WNYC's online services. Click the ePledge button to make your gift now. And thanks.
From New York Public Radio, this is On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at wnyc.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. If the junior Democratic senator from Illinois was not already a household name after his acclaimed speech at the 2004 Democratic National Convention, he certainly was this Monday.
The story that has caused a sensation tonight, Illinois Democratic Senator Barack Obama.
If the first test of the 08 presidential race is media attention during the 06 midterms, Barack Obama is this year's rock star.
Illinois Senator Barack Obama is the Democratic Party's great young hope.
Illinois Senator Barack Obama, the newest and at the moment the brightest star in the Democratic sky. He's been on the cover of Time, Newsweek, even Men's Vogue.
The media were all abuzz about Obama after his appearance on NBC's Meet the Press when he told Tim Russert that he might possibly, perhaps, almost certainly, just say it.
But it's fair to say you're thinking about running for president in 2008.
It's fair, yes.
Coming, as his announcement did, on the heels of the Time magazine story and his new and well-received second book, media across the political spectrum are chanting, "Run, Barack, run." William Powers, who writes the off-message column for the National Journal, has anatomized the rise of candidates in years past, and he joins us now. Bill, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Brooke. Great to be here.
So you noted back in 2002 that there were, in fact, 7 media milestones on the road to becoming a viable presidential candidate. Is Obama on course?
He is, in my opinion, very much sticking to the pattern, Brooke. There was getting to know you, which takes a few years, and that happened, of course, leading up to the convention where he gave his famous speech. And then that also encompasses step number 2, which is the run-up. And now we're basically in number 3. This explosion is kind of the validation, the he has arrived, he is perfect. Step 4 is also happening now, which is the think piece phase, where Obama is not just a person, he's a vehicle. He encapsulates all kinds of social trends.
And who's thinking about him?
I think he may have set a new record for a number of columnists to write about the same person in 1 week at the New York Times. He snagged almost every major columnist and slayed them all, including even the very difficult Michiko Kakutani reviewing his book. And then there are longer think pieces. Time magazine had one by Joe Klein. There's a more kind of investigative slash think piece on the cover of Harper's. The list goes on and on.
So as he proceeds along this 7-step continuum, where's he fallen short?
Well, number 5 is also starting to happen, which is the meta piece, which is where people start to write about the Obama phenomenon as a phenomenon and sort of try and step back from it and almost make fun of it a little bit, which is happening. Maureen Dowd's column was an example of that, where she tried to make light of the tidal wave, but she wound up saying, hilariously, that he is intriguingly imperfect. So that even his imperfections were intriguing in Maureen Dowd's estimation. And finally, Brooke, that takes us to number 6, a long lead up to the next step that has not happened yet, which is the flop, which has happened to so many of these sort of ingenue candidates. The one I wrote about originally when I laid out these steps was John Edwards, who had the, at the time, notorious flop on Tim Russert's Meet the Press. Obama has cleared that gauntlet, but I have a feeling there's got to be something bad in store for him down the road, because there always is for one of these folks.
And sooner better than later?
Yeah, I mean, the timing of the flop is very interesting and crucial. You know, Howard Dean had his flop at the worst possible time, you know, the Dean scream moment. he peaked early and then he flopped late, in a way. And Obama has talked about the problem of peaking early and has said, you know, you can't really control these things. And he sort of has shrugged it off.
In this recent round of what a lot of people are calling Obama mania, would you say that there is now a media consensus about Obama, that he's just the natural?
Oh, I think there's a consensus that he is the natural, the most preternatural political figure we have seen since the Kennedys. The Kennedys come up constantly in these comparisons.
The Kennedys or one particular Kennedy?
Bobby and John come up sometimes together, sometimes separately. All kinds of combinations of Kennedys come up. The Kennedy trope is actually a part of this whole process of the arrival of the new Democratic politician. You have to work in a Kennedy in some way. But Obama's arrival is unusually Kennedy rich, partly because he himself harks back in a lot of his positions and his aspirations to those figures in that period. You know, Brooke, one of the things that hasn't come up in any of these pieces that I note about him is just kind of aesthetically, the way he dresses, the way he wears his hair, his mannerisms, the way he talks. He's kind of a 1950s, early 1960s looking guy. Have you noticed that?
I know what you mean. He has the boxy suits and the narrow ties, but it's sort of in a retro way, sort of more David Byrne than man in the gray flannel suit.
It's got a hip feeling to it, but he also, it's like he stepped out of a Jack Lemmon movie or something. That period, and it kind of, in a subconscious way, I think, it echoes this connection that people are making to that time.
You know, I am put in mind a little of the mania for Colin Powell that happened, partly because he is how we want to think of ourselves.
Joe Klein writes about this in his Time cover story about Obama. The kind of the pleasure factor, particularly in the white person reacting to Obama, you know, there's almost a, he didn't use this word, but a self-congratulatory element to it where we feel even better about ourselves because he is of mixed race and because he seems to represent this principle of the kind of country we'd like to live in.
Bill, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Brooke. Great to be here.
William Powers writes the off-message column for the National Journal. Whoever ends up running in 2008, wrote Paul Waldman on TomPaine.com recently, Barack Obama, quote, at the very least, offers Democrats a lesson in how powerful rhetoric can capture and exploit a political moment. Waldman is a senior fellow at the progressive think tank Media Matters for America. Paul, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
So even before Obama was elected senator, he gave the keynote address at the Democratic National Convention in July of 2004. And it was the first time that most Americans laid eyes on the guy. What did he accomplish in that maiden TV appearance?
What he did was he firmly created a political identity for himself. He starts off the speech by talking about his own heritage, who his parents were and his grandparents were. Smart politicians know that politics is really about identity more so than issues. And so if you look at the emotional climax of the speech, it comes when he's giving a litany about hope.
It's the hope of slaves sitting around a fire singing freedom songs. The hope of immigrants setting out for distant shores. The hope of a young naval lieutenant bravely patrolling the Mekong Delta. The hope of a mill worker's son who dares to defy the odds. The hope of a skinny kid with a funny name who believes that America has a place for him too.
We look up at that moment as he's standing on the stage, and the question is, does America have a place for him too? And of course, the answer is yes, because here's this figure of Barack Obama giving this speech to millions of Americans.
And actually, he answers that question himself in a different part of the speech when he describes how the red states and the blue states really aren't all that different after all.
We worship an awesome God in the blue states, and we don't like federal agents poking around in our libraries in the red states. We coach Little League in the blue states, and yes, we've got some gay friends in the red states.
So what Obama's doing here is he's taking what could be disadvantages for him in those two passages, his multiracial heritage and this name that sounds strange to American ears, and He's turning them into advantages. He's saying that he is the embodiment of what we want America to be. We want America to get beyond these racial divides. We want America to be able to get beyond the red-blue divides. And he's offering himself as kind of the vehicle, the expression of the solution to those problems.
But in a speech he gave a year later that you've taken note of, Paul, it was at the commencement of Knox College, and it wasn't a speech that many people heard. He was much more partisan, a lot more ideological. And he even takes some jabs at what conservatives like our president call the ownership society.
It's a tempting idea because it doesn't require much thought or ingenuity. It allows us to say that those whose health care or tuition may rise faster than they can afford, tough luck. It allows us to say to the Maytag workers who've lost their job, life isn't fair. It lets us say to the child who's born into poverty, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. But there's a problem. It won't work. It ignores our history.
So in the DNC speech, he's very inclusive. There doesn't seem to be a bad person or a bad idea possible within it. And in this one, there's a slew of bad ideas, usually conservative ones, that have been defeated by progressive ones that have allowed America to become the great country that it is. There's an inherent contradiction, isn't there?
Maybe there is and maybe there isn't. He seems to be saying in the DNC speech that the things that divide us are not so great as we might think from watching what happens in the media or what happens in Washington. In the Knox College speech, he's saying essentially that conservatives were wrong, but he's not really making an argument about whether or not they're bad people. So he is walking a fine line there, and maybe it won't be successful or maybe it will. We'll have to see how he continues to reframe that if he becomes a candidate.
These speeches are really impressive. I mean, they fall beautifully, gracefully on the ear. Do you think that he represents a step forward or maybe a step backward into a great tradition of American political rhetoric that's been lacking lately?
Well, political rhetoric is always changing. One of the things that Obama does, there's actually a parallel with Ronald Reagan. Reagan, at his rhetorical high points of his presidency, was always talking about us as Americans. Ordinary people were the heroes of the stories that he told. George W. Bush, in contrast, is the hero of the stories that George W. Bush tells.
Give me an example of that.
If you look at the video that they made for Reagan's reelection convention in 1984, the high point of that is a speech that he gave on the 40th anniversary of D-Day, and they intercut it with some new material where he's talking about the men who took the cliffs at Normandy. And he says afterward, where do we find such men? We find them where we've always found them, in the shops, on the main streets, in the offices. They're the product of the freest society the world has ever known. Bush's reelection convention, on the other hand, had a video that was just as artfully produced. And what was it about? It was about George Bush going out and throwing the first pitch at Yankee Stadium after 9/11. It's very different from Reagan's rhetoric, which is about who we are as Americans. And Obama does a lot of that same kind of talk. He wants us to see him as the embodiment of what we want to believe about America. There is a real parallel with Reagan there. Whether that will be successful, I think, remains to be seen.
Thanks very much, Paul.
It's been my pleasure.
Paul Waldman, Senior Fellow at Media Matters for America and author of Being Right is Not Enough: What Progressives Must Learn from Conservative Success.
Coming up, Republican ads this season don't use the R word. And you know who they don't mention? The guy who runs the country.
This is On the Media from NPR.
We'll be right back.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Looking at the campaign ads now flooding the airwaves and the internet, you can't help but notice two interesting trends. First, Republicans dare not speak their name.
Independent, effective, Congressman Clayshaw.
Thelma Drake, honest, independent, doing what's right.
Congresswoman Deborah Price, independent, experienced, effective.
Independently, effectively, courageously. Congressman John Sweeney, a New York story.
And then there's the second trend, Democrats wanting to cast their Republican opponents as the spawn of Bush. Any photo of a GOP candidate posing with the president is being treated by Democrats like a smoking gun for sympathy with the devil.
On every important vote for George Bush's agenda, Rob Simmons has been there.
This year, we have a choice. A congressman who stands with George Bush and his special interest friends, or someone who will stand...
The people running this war are incompetent.
And all John Cal does is make excuses for Bush.
This week, we're zooming in on the Senate race in densely populated New Jersey, where Democrats usually win, but not necessarily, and where candidates must spend very big bucks to place ads in both the New York and Philadelphia media markets in order to be seen and heard throughout New Jersey. The Senate race in New Jersey is between Democratic incumbent Robert Menendez and Republican challenger Thomas Kane Jr. It's one of only four Senate races that the New York Times deems a toss-up at this point. WNYC reporter Bob Henley has been covering the race and watching the commercials, and he joins me now with his report. Bob, welcome to OTM.
Afflicted by the commercials, actually.
I feel your pain. Republicans, I guess, are running from the word Republican in their advertising. It's apparently confusing to some people. You had a conversation with the voter who was flummoxed by the whole thing.
Well, flummoxed or informed. What happened was Scott Garrett is a congressman from northern New Jersey. He's very conservative, very Republican, except this year he sent his mass mailer out without reference to his party orientation and thus made himself, at least to this voter, more accessible because, as she pointed out, normally she doesn't look at any kind of Republican literature.
That's why I ended up reading his literature, because usually when I see Republican, I throw it in the garbage, no offense to the Republicans.
As a matter of fact, when we finished our chat, she had convinced herself she was indeed going to vote for Scott Garrett because he was a, quote, independent voice for the environment.
Now, what about the Kane race? He also exactly isn't wearing his GOP elephant on his sleeve, is he?
What Kane has been doing is running himself as a reformer who's going to clean up Trenton. And, of course, being a U.S. senator, the focus would be Washington. But as you hear in this ad, he very much wants to agitate voters about what's happened with New Jersey's Democratic Party, where Menendez is vulnerable. And that's why this kind of ad is very effective.
Bob Menendez is under federal criminal investigation for steering $9 million in taxpayer money to a Hudson County group, then taking over $300,000 for himself.
Okay, a vote for Menendez is a vote for New Jersey corruption. But the Democrats on their side are saying that a vote for a Kane is a vote for George Bush. Tell me what that advertising looks like.
It's very reliant on the war in Iraq as the major driver here. One of the things that's happened in New Jersey ahead of perhaps the nation is that they don't see a connection between 9/11 and the war in Iraq and haven't for a while. They're about running 18 months ahead of the national average on this. And so by this point, I think some two-thirds of the public believes that the war is not going well. And so the degree to which that Menendez can capitalize on that, he's going to advance himself. Menendez also has the actual historical distinction of being one of the few House members who voted against the Iraq war early on.
The New York Times, in its online election guide for 2006, describes the races in every state. And for New Jersey, the little blurb says, the tight race will probably be decided by TV commercials. That is quite a statement. Do you actually think it's true?
No. It's about turnout. Who can manage to motivate their base and tug on the independents to follow through and vote. We're in a period of civic disengagement right now in America. People get disillusioned by these ads, get turned off. 1970 was the best year for looking at comparisons. That was a time where America was at war abroad and had high anxiety at home. In that election, 70% of the people bothered to turn out. Experts are expecting between 45 to 50% to turn out this time.
Bob, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Bob Henley is a reporter for WNYC. The media say that the midterm election will serve as a referendum on the war and on the leadership in Washington. But voters can't cast ballots reflecting their doubts about voting, and the media suggests there's plenty to doubt. In the 6 years since the Supreme Court determined that George Bush would be president, problems ranging from voter suppression to the easy manipulation of electronic voting machines have not been solved. Here's CNN's Wolf Blitzer.
When it comes to casting your vote in the ever-growing electronic age, some are deeply concerned right now about massive errors or even stolen votes.
There is a fine line between information and fear-mongering, and the way the problem is framed could determine whether voters go to the polls. Michael Waldman is the executive director of the Brennan Center for Justice at the NYU School of Law. He's concerned, and he joins me now. Michael, welcome to OTM.
My pleasure.
In October, the Brennan Center held a briefing for reporters. What, first of all, were you trying to tell the media?
Well, what we were hoping that we could do in talking to the media was to show how, for all the focus that happens on Election Day, with all the kinds of shenanigans and voter suppression and people being told wrong polling places or told to vote the next day, that the real voter suppression that happens very often happens not just in November, but in October and September and year-round.
From the questions that the reporters raised at this briefing, were you able to divine whether their understanding of what's important and newsworthy corresponds with your thoughts on the subject?
Many of the questions were about voter fraud. And I think that one of the things that has happened is the media admirably is covering this issue now. It's admirably covering the mechanics of democracy. But there's sometimes a false equivalence based on charges from one side or another. The other day, The Note, which is the publication of ABC News, its political section, said that one of the ways you can tell that the mainstream media has a liberal bias is if it gives more attention to voter suppression than to voter fraud. Well, the only problem with that is that, in fact, there's plenty of evidence of voter suppression and precious little evidence of actual voter fraud. It's like what Stephen Colbert said, which is sometimes the facts have a bias.
Now, the idea of fraud still lives, especially on the internet, in the blogosphere. There's essentially two sets of charges. From the left, the idea that electronic voting machines can be rigged and the implication that they have been rigged. And from the political right, the idea that the Democrats are bussing in, say, illegal aliens to vote Democratic and deprive Republicans of their seats in Congress and so forth. Is there any evidence out there in recent history of either of those kinds of voter fraud actually having taken place?
Well, in terms of the kind of allegation of voter fraud where somebody's voting who's not supposed to be voting, you often see news articles recycling the same examples. There's a person in Ohio who registered to vote under the name of Jive Turkey, and you can find that many, many times on the blogosphere and in news coverage, but Mr. Turkey has not actually ever showed up to vote. He did register, but he didn't show up to vote. In terms of whether there's potential fraud and hacking in electronic systems, we don't know. That's a more complex and real challenge. These electronic systems are being used now for the first time by 80% of voters. At the Brennan Center, the group I run, actually convened a task force of computer scientists from inside and outside the government. And we looked at this and said, well, could you really hack these machines? And actually, it turns out you can quite easily. What this group of scientists concluded is you could walk in with a Palm Pilot and steal a Senate election. So we, of course, don't know if it's happened before, but it is a very legitimate concern going forward.
Now, the question of voter suppression is different because on that there is a vast paper trail because a lot of it was done via legislation, some of which hasn't been overturned by the courts. Do you believe the coverage historically of attempts at voter suppression has been up to snuff?
It's been very spotty. You have situations, for example, in Florida and Ohio and a number of other key states in 2004, there was a real upsurge in voting. Many people of color, many young people voted for the first time, and they were registered to vote by nonprofit groups. Well, the state legislatures in Florida and Ohio and elsewhere cracked down on this terrible social problem of people voting by passing draconian laws that made it a crime, in effect, to make a mistake in turning in a voter registration form. Federal courts have found repeatedly in Florida, in Ohio, that this is not just a bad idea, not just bad policy, but it's illegal, it's unconstitutional. the press hasn't really gone behind this to say, well, why is this happening? Who's behind it? Why is this popping up in state after state? And why is this part of somebody's strategy? I think that there's been occasionally good coverage, but the dots have not been connected.
Who's done a good job on this?
The New York Times has done quite a bit of work. There are newspapers such as USA Today that have done a very good job on electronic voting. And some newspapers have done a terrific job at actually digging in and looking at the allegations of fraud and finding that they're not what they cracked up to be. There's a blog called Brad Blog, which is a tremendous repository of information about voting. It's where a lot of the activists and experts go to look. But there's much more that could be done. And, you know, believe me that right now there are people sitting in offices trying to figure out how to keep people from voting. And it's something that the media can do to try and open those doors and find out who they are and why they're doing this and what they're up to.
Well, Michael, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Michael Waldman is the executive director of the Brennan Center for Justice at the NYU School of Law. Weeks ago, a blogger named Michael Rogers appeared on the Ed Schultz Show, an explicitly liberal syndicated radio program, to talk about what he'd reported on his blog, the allegation that Idaho Republican Senator Larry Craig is a closeted homosexual. Rogers, who has made a vocation of outing prominent officials he deems hypocritical, pointed to Craig's 100% gay, unfriendly voting record to justify the invasion of the senator's personal privacy. Though his previous outings have never been found wrong, Rogers offered only the testimony of four men whom he did not name. This posed a quandary for the Spokane Spokesman Review, whose circulation covers much of northern Idaho, and how it handled the story speaks volumes about how the digital age has changed the calculus on questions of privacy, discretion, and, notably in this case, journalistic transparency. Steve Smith is the editor of the Spokesman Review, and he joins us now. Steve, welcome back to On the Media.
Well, thank you very much, Bob.
Now, I'm going to assume that this particular blog post didn't shock anybody at the Spokesman Review. There have been unsubstantiated rumors about Senator Craig's sexuality for years, no?
The rumors really go back to 1982, and it's not been a story that we've pursued because there's been no indication that his behavior crosses the line into any sort of illegal activity.
Now, this time you did write a story. What changed in terms of the story's relevance?
Well, context in something like this is everything. And the story at this point is, in part, assertions of Craig's sexuality, but it's also very much the impact of those assertions and the public buzz developing during a very contentious election season, and where the Foley scandal is so fresh in people's minds, and in our local area, the Jim West scandal is so fresh, it took on a relevance that it might not have had at another time or place.
It was less than 2 years ago, I guess, that you were reporting on the sexual indiscretions of West, who was the mayor of Spokane at the time. Briefly tell me about that scandal and how it played out.
Well, that was a case where a public official was involved in inappropriate conduct on two levels. One, allegations of sexual abuse in his past, 30 or so years ago, and then allegations that he was, in present time, patrolling the internet, attempting to engage in sexual encounters with young men. The third leg of that story was the hypocrisy of a closeted gay politician who, in public, took very homophobic positions. As a collection of elements, there was never any question in our mind that that was a story that required pursuit on our part.
So this time around, in the Craig case, mm-hmm. was it the third leg of the stool, the question of public hypocrisy, that finally helped you make your decision to run the story? Or was it just the fact that the story was already in play?
That's exactly the point. The fact that it was a story in Idaho, that it was a story in the community and was generating enormous heat in the blogosphere, which we monitor closely, telling us that it was having a material effect on the political climate in Idaho, where Larry Craig is campaigning actively for the Republican gubernatorial candidate. That compelled us in the end to decide that we had to acknowledge the existence of the story and discuss the impact on Idaho politics.
To me, one of the most interesting aspects of this story was the degree of transparency the Spokesman Review gave readers about the decision-making process.
We have an ongoing blog called The News is a Conversation. It's part of our Transparent Newsroom initiative. And we posted online a brief summary of the conundrum that we were facing and asked people to weigh in if they had any thoughts. The next morning, once the decision was made and the story was published, we do webcast our morning news meetings, and we talked about our decision-making process and then had people weigh in all through the course of the day on two or three different blogs that we run out of the newsroom. And we took about 50 or 60 active comments from readers during the course of about 16 hours.
What you've just described has a sort of opposing mirrors quality to it. I mean, I guess it's to your credit that you were so transparent, but for one thing, what if you had decided in all of these deliberations that the right move was not to run a story in the print edition of the Spokesman Review? In effect, by airing the deliberations, you already had run the story. Doesn't that put you in a very vulnerable position in the future if, say, the government or, a libel plaintiff is trying to get the records of your news deliberations?
There's no question that it's gray territory. Posting this particular item, we were careful to discern whether there was a legal liability issue. And I think the distinction that we drew, which is arguable, is that the environment in which we were discussing our decision-making process was the very environment in which this discussion was already taking place. And we were simply joining that conversation in as careful and thoughtful a way as we possibly could. But you're right. Had we chosen then not to produce a story in print, the conversation and the discussion itself certainly would have telegraphed the fact that this story exists to anybody who is tuning in. It's a puzzlement. We're just trying to come to grips with this new environment.
Okay, Steve. Once again, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Steve Smith is the editor of the Spokane Spokesman Review.
Coming up, can a great big dose of reality cure the ailing network that once gave us must-see TV?
This is On the Media from NPR.
NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Last week, NBC announced a radical cost-cutting measure they've branded NBC Universal 2.0. The plan will eliminate about 700 jobs and nearly all scripted programming between 8 and 9 in the evening. NBC CEO Jeff Zucker says the changes pave the way for a digital future and reflect changing viewing habits. Sitcoms and dramas, costly to produce, aren't being watched as much in that first hour of NBC primetime. Most of the hits in that hour have been less expensive game shows like Deal or No Deal and The Apprentice. But not only does the network have to convince analysts and advertisers that it's still viable, it has to reassure them that the model of ad-supported broadcast TV itself still works. John Higgins is the business editor for Broadcasting and Cable magazine. He says that NBC has drawn attention to itself, but publicizing cost-cutting may be another misstep.
This is hysterical. It's the first time I've ever seen a company try to brand a layoff. NBC is in a very bleak situation. They dropped from first place to fourth with absolutely incredible speed. They're trying to pick up the slack by putting on NFL games on Sunday nights, which is really doing great things to their ratings, but it's doing horrible things to their profits. NFL games are so expensive, $10 million an hour, basically, that, you know, they don't really get any profits. GE and GE's investors want them to bolster the bottom line. And they've proven they can't do it through smart programming. They need to make cuts.
The argument that Jeffrey Zucker made for putting reality only from this point forward in the first hour of prime time is that it costs something like 40 cents on the dollar compared to scripted shows. I guess under the circumstances, they just can't afford to pay the huge dollars to do a scripted drama or a sitcom.
They can't afford it because they don't have the ratings. ABC's got Ugly Betty at 8 o'clock on Thursdays. They seem pretty happy. Lost seemed to do pretty well at 8 o'clock when it debuted two seasons ago. I don't think J.J. Abrams, the producer, is complaining about that scheduling move.
Obviously, they're going budget for the first hour of primetime, but another big victim here will apparently be the various news operations that NBC runs, both on broadcast and cable.
The thing to recognize in this layoff is that the news division has taken the biggest hit. News has traditionally produced half the profits on NBC broadcast. That was when primetime was actually profitable. Right now, about the only thing that's profitable on NBC broadcast is the Today Show and the evening news. The problem is that's where the bodies are. I mean, two-thirds of the people at NBC's television operation are at the news division. You know, news is pretty labor-intensive. So if you're going to cut, if you're looking to boost profits, you don't have many other places to turn.
Apart from the general wisdom of cutting off the leg of your cash cow, what do you suppose the effect will be on the quality of the news operation? You know, 700 layoffs later.
You will see fewer reporters in the field. You'll see fewer people going overseas. You'll see smaller crews. You'll see more consolidation in the operations of the various news outlets. The folks at CNBC are going to want much different shots of an event than Access Hollywood will. But under this plan, there will only be maybe one crew. And, you know, they'll all kind of have the same shots, the same edits for the same story, which kind of threatens like the individual personalities of the outlets. Although probably only astute viewers will really see a lot of difference.
Part of this NBC 2.0 thing is to pave the way for the increasingly digital future and to find ways to distribute NBC content over the internet, which raises the question of who gets skipped in that process? Isn't it the local affiliates, the local broadcast stations? What happens when they get cut out of the distribution loop? And what effect will that have on networks as we know them?
The affiliates, and even NBC's own local stations, are going to get crushed in this. The primetime programming is so important for them to promote themselves and to promote their local newscast. You know, you want to feed into 11 o'clock on the East Coast for your newscast. That's really tough when NBC's best programming is available on the internet. They're going to have to figure out how to make money locally where they're not relying on the primetime programming to drive that traffic. Some stations will be very, very good at it. Every town probably has two stations that do a pretty good newscast, but it's the guys that don't have good newscasts. You know, those are the folks that are in real trouble because if probably you've got a Seinfeld reruns, you don't have a lot to offer when viewers increasingly turn to the internet for their video.
All right, John. Thank you once again for joining us.
Hey, appreciate the time.
John Higgins is the business editor for Broadcasting and Cable magazine.
Warren Littlefield joined NBC during another downturn in 1979. Eventually, he ran the entertainment division, presiding over many of the network's best years. He joins us now to relive the good, the bad, and the ugly. Warren, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, can we do a quick history of NBC's entertainment programming? You lived through a lot of it in your nearly 20 years there. I know that it struggled through most of the 70s, but the worst year was 1983 when Fred Silverman was in charge. There were 9 new series launched. Bay City Blues, Boone, For Love and Honor, Jennifer Slept Here, The Rousters, Mr. Smith, We've Got It Made, The Yellow Rose, and Manimal.
Jonathan Chase, master of the secrets that divide man from animal. Animal from man. Manimal.
Wow. That was a pretty scary time. We sat around Brandon Tartikoff's office at night, and we were convinced that we were all going to be fired.
9 shows launched, all of them canceled, an unprecedented achievement in network TV. What went wrong?
I don't think we were respecting the audience. We were thinking about the audience as those people out there. And I don't think we were putting on television programming and developing programs that would have us flying down the freeway, racing to get to our television sets because we desperately wanted to see something that we believed was good.
So if not respecting the audience is what went wrong earlier on, is respecting the audience what went right?
I think when Cheers came along, in the 84 season, NBC finally had a signature comedy. And Cheers was a really, really slow starter. It finished its first season as the lowest rated half hour in all of television. We loved it, and so that's why we renewed it. And that's when Thursday Night came to life. Cosby, Family Ties, Cheers, Night Court, those were the kings of comedy, and that turned around the network.
Now, NBC, as you've observed, used to be able to afford a few flops. Are they so much more expensive now?
The cost of failure in the business is greater than it's ever been before. And if there is clear-cut rejection, then you pretty much don't have a choice. Seinfeld, the research was disastrous. People thought the show was too Jewish. Seinfeld very easily could have died, and yet we thought there was something there that had to be kept alive.
NBC is now gasping for breath again. It's shifted to a primetime schedule largely devoted to reality TV. Would you call this a path-breaking risk, or is it just a cost-saving measure? Does it mark the end of the network sitcom and drama?
Well, I don't think it's the end. There are new shows that are introduced all the time that still capture millions and millions of American viewers. And yet, without someone putting their body on the tracks, unless you have that kind of support, things don't happen. And I think ultimately, these are times where networks are tested.
Warren, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Warren Littlefield is currently president of the Littlefield Company, a television production company.
Everybody knows your name.
In 1976, Barbara Walters' $1 million contract was paid half by ABC News and half by the network's entertainment division. When the movie Network was released, she was a bit defensive, telling TV critic Tom Shales that there would never be, quote, that kind of showbiz approach to the news the film depicted. In Network, an anchorman erupts and calls on viewers to join him in an iconic primal scream, to wit, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. And in that, he reflected his creator, screenwriter Patty Chayefsky. From New York, WNYC's Sarah Fischko offers this profile.
We're live in 8, 7, 6.
A few weeks ago, on the season premiere of Aaron Sorkin's TV show Studio 60, one of the show's characters went berserk live on the air.
Change the channel. Turn off your
Let's do it right now. Go ahead.
Doing a kind of insane truth-telling about television and society.
We're all being lobotomized by this country's most influential industry.
The style was frankly inspired by Howard Beale, the crazed anchorman of the film Network, the character created by screenwriter Paddy Chayefsky decades ago.
In a scene reminiscent of Paddy Chayefsky's classic film Network,
he was mad as hell and he wasn't going to take it anymore.
Network, now 30 years old, has come back in a big way this year, as has the memory of the Bronx-born writer who brought it to the screen. Chayefsky's career was meteoric and really very unwriter-like.
What do you feel like doing tonight?
I don't know, Ange. What do you feel like doing?
He had come into the public consciousness for the first time with the film Marty, whose two guys in a bar dialogue had quickly entered the language.
I say to you, what do you feel like doing tonight? And you say back to me, I don't know, what do you feel like doing tonight? Then we wind up sitting around your house with a couple of cans of beer watching a hit parade on television.
The story of a lonely butcher and a timid school teacher who find love. It had originally been a live TV drama with Rod Steiger and Nancy Marchand in 1953, and it became a phenomenon.
It was instantaneous. Overnight, everybody connected with it.
Sean Considine's 1994 biography of Chayefsky, Mad as Hell, has been reprinted this year. He says the dialogue in Marty is what captivated audiences, and actors, too. Nancy Marchand said the words just fell off your tongue. And the program really did explode onto the screen in its own quiet way that night in 1953.
The next day, the actors were walking on the street, and everybody had seen it or seen Rod Steiger and said, they were yelling out the windows, "Hey, Marty!"
Chayefsky, born Sidney Chayefsky and nicknamed Paddy in the Army, had started out wanting to be a playwright, but he'd gone to Hollywood when one of his magazine stories was bought by a studio. Out there in the late 40s, it was not the best time for writers.
They were the lowest on the totem pole. Ben Hecht said, they were a cross between a doormat and a groundhog.
And when the studio turned Paddy's script over to one writer after another for revisions, Chayefsky walked out.
He was not happy with that situation. He decided that if he ever went back to Hollywood, he would have total control.
Marty was his chance. It was in his contract that only he could do the rewrites this time. And as far as anyone knew, it was the first such arrangement. The movie starred Ernest Borgnine and Betsy Blair, and it sold out night after night in New York. It was cheered at the Cannes Film Festival, and it won Chayefsky his first screenwriting Oscar. He was already the writer as major star.
You know what my last picture, Stardust Girl, did in New York City opening week?
He fought for creative control again and won in The Goddess, his 1958 movie about the rise of a Hollywood screen idol played by Kim Stanley and inspired by the life of Marilyn Monroe.
All you know is I just run off on me.
Again, the dialogue dominated.
I hate you so much, I don't know how to tell you how much I hate you. You just get out of my house, just get out!
In fact, at that point, the writer of the movie, Chayefsky, was a much bigger star than the actress, Kim Stanley. They even promoted the film with a picture of our hero toiling at his typewriter. Still, with all his success in movies, his dream was to be writing great plays. He wrote them, and a few were produced in New York, but they weren't quite great enough to be taken seriously.
The New York critics, you know, had savaged his work. So that's where all the fury and the anger come. He never became the playwright he thought he should have been, like an Arthur Miller or a Tennessee Williams. So he decided to turn around, and he would take the gifts he had as a playwright and bring them to the screen, and he started that with the hospital.
What are you going to do about those 14 ghetto people, baby?
I am not going to do anything.
We were coming out of 1969, 1970. It was, you know, drug use, had the crime, the corruption, everything had escalated. So he used hospital as a microcosm of society in New York. That's what he used, or contemporary society.
It is all rubbish.
By the time of The Hospital, starring George C. Scott, Chayefsky had arrived at a kind of speechifying that really hadn't been heard in movies in just that way.
We have established the most enormous medical entity ever conceived, and people are sicker than ever. We cure nothing! We heal nothing!
And the speeches that he had in The Goddess now became arias, practically, in hospital. This suicidal doctor, who was essentially, who was Paddy, as was Howard Beale, the mad anchorman in Network. These were Paddy Chayefsky.
We know the air is unfit to breathe and our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes, as if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore.
Chayefsky's always been my sole role model as a screenwriter.
Notorious bad boy screenwriter Joe Esterhaus was in town recently promoting his new book, The Devil's Guide to Hollywood, The Screenwriter as God. Esterhaus wrote Basic Instinct and Jagged Edge, among other films. We wound up talking about Paddy Chayefsky.
What he did, as opposed to almost all screenwriters, is fight tooth and nail to the wall, clawing, using his elbows, using his knees to preserve his vision.
Why did he have to fight so hard? Because everyone, says Joe Esterhaus, everyone's a writer.
Whether you're talking about the studio executive or the actor or the cab driver, you know, or the gopher or the gaffer or the director, they all think they're writers and they all want to change and rewrite what you've done. It's insanity. The only way to stop that is by fighting, and then that's what Paddy did.
After Network, for which he won his third Oscar, there were terrible problems for Chayefsky with a film called Altered States. Suffice it to say, they found new ways to challenge Chayefsky's control. And without that, says biographer Sean Considine, he was a desperate man.
The control took over. He was controlaholic. That killed him. The rage killed him.
It broke Paddy's heart.
Paddy Chayefsky died in 1981 at age 58.
His final words were, "I tried." And then I think they are the most heartbreaking words coming from a screenwriter.
We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone.
Unless you count the words from Network, the popular film about a popular medium that went too far for comfort.
Everything he spoke about happened.
I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the...
That Chayefsky speechifying, corny and overdrawn and on the brink of absurdity though it may be, still makes us listen.
My life has value!
Even a little harder now. For On the Media, I'm Sarah Fishko.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson our engineer. We had engineering help from Wayne Schulmeister and other help from Alicia Rebensdorf and Michael McLaughlin. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at WNYC.org. And thanks.